Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
God, I loved it. I'll send you a copy. Bam! Bitch went down.
Welcome back to Horror Queers. We're talking not scary movies, just a lot of bees. I'm Joe.
And I'm Trace.
And we are joined by a very special guest, Cap. Are you there?
I am here. Hi, I'm Cap Blackard.
And Cap, give yourself a little intro. Who are you? Why should people know you?
Well, folks should know me from my prolific decade in podcasting, beginning with the Nerdy Show Network and a series of shows therein, most notably my RPG audio dramas. And I also happen to run Consequence of Sound's Consequence Podcast Network. In the horror world, I am perhaps best known as the showrunner for the audio drama series The Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program, a Lovecraftian black comedy.
Nice.
I like that.
All right. And so I was very unhelpful off the top, but we are talking about the Wicker Man and not the good Wicker Man. We're talking about the bad Wicker Man, people.
Well, we are talking about the Neil LaBute's remake of The Wicker Man. And obviously, you know, as I always want to kind of give a heads up to our listeners, no outright queer content up front. But man, is it campy as fuck.
Oh my goodness. I haven't seen this film in quite a number of years, and I always forget because it kind of starts okay, and then it just gets so fucking crazy.
Oh boy, it kind of starts okay. We have very differing opinions already.
I will confess, I don't think this movie is terrible. It's not good. I mean, I don't think it's a good movie. But I just finished watching the commentary, so I've watched this movie twice in 24 hours.
Again, so sorry.
And it's kind of sad because they recorded the commentary before the release.
Oh, so they still think it's good.
Yes. Well, here's the thing. Okay, on this commentary is Neil LaBute and Lily Sobieski and Kate Behan, who plays Willow, and the costume designer and the editor.
Oh, that's too many people on a single commentary, too.
It is, and it's most, LaBute kind of dominates it. Like, I don't know, he kind of came across as kind of douchey in the commentary, which I kind of expected, but yeah, he really thinks he's making a good movie here, and I just don't think he understands the horror genre.
No, like, not at all.
He also doesn't understand women, filmmaking, beyond a collegiate edgelord kind of level, and what was good about The Wicker Man to begin with. Because there's no semblance of it.
Well, there was one thing he said in the commentary where he goes, oh, well, you know, the first one wasn't really a horror movie. And you're like, yeah, it kind of is.
I'm shocked actually to agree with him. I believe it was a horror movie at the time, but has transmogrified into something else at this point. It also depends on your background. If we want to address the original Wicker Man at this juncture particularly, but I have a lot of thoughts about it. And I love it.
I'm very much looking forward to it. I just saw it for the first time over the weekend. So I'd seen the remake once before. So I'd seen the remake again before I ever saw the original. And I must say, I did enjoy the original quite a bit.
It's a very kooky, interesting film. And I think it's actually aged really well. But anyway, yeah, let's run through the sheet.
I actually really do want to talk about LaBute specifically. And obviously, as we get into the plot, we'll comparisons to the original and discussions about the differences will be had. So yes, this is The Wicker Man. It was released September 1st, 2006 by Warner Brothers. And it has a runtime of 106 minutes, but my Blu-ray is definitely 101 minutes. So maybe the theatrical is a bit different than the unrated. With a budget of $40 million? I don't know where it went. I guess I'm going to say from all the actors.
They did have to rent that small island.
Yes. Opened at number 3 behind the second weekend of the Mark Wahlberg football movie Invincible and the first weekend of Jason Statham's Crank. Hmm. Crank's really good, by the way.
Yeah.
And it had $9.6 million for an opening weekend. And if you adjust that to 2019 money, you're looking at about $24 million. ended its domestic run with $32.6 million, with a worldwide total of $38.8 million. So it did not make its money back in any shape, way, or form.
It was a big hit all around.
Yeah. My sister actually saw this in theaters. I remember I was working at the movie theater when this came out, and I didn't go see it. So sorry, movie.
Oh, don't apologize to this movie.
Yeah, no, it apologizes to you, which, I mean, it probably won't because it's too indignant about itself, but...
You can feel, like, the disdain for casual viewers just dripping off the screen.
Yeah, it's a movie that exists. Well, clearly no one liked this movie when it came out, and it's definitely kind of become the butt of a lot of jokes, but, you know, if you're looking at just general critical consensus, Rotten Tomatoes, you've got a 15% from critics and a 17% from audiences, so, you know, one of the few movies we've covered in this podcast where critics and general audiences seem to agree on things. And then Metacritic score of 36 out of 100 and a user score of 2.2 out of 10. So,
ouch. I think this is one of those coveted F cinema scores, isn't it?
Yes. This and Bug are the two 2006 horror movies that got F cinema scores.
Those are very different films, and one deserves a different fate.
Yes.
And it is not this one.
No, it's not this one. So, we'll just start right away. So, directed and written by Neil LaBute. Are y'all familiar with his body of work?
I'm familiar with his early stuff. Cap, do you know him?
I mean, I've scoped it out, and then I've scoped him out, and I have a lot of things to say about him that I can report on, but not because I have a relationship with him or his work.
No, by all means. I mean, I'm very familiar with his work. I've only seen a few of his films, but I like or love all of them. Like, I mean, he broke out in the scene within the Company of Men, which is a very, very dark comedy, which seems to be where he excels. But it also has, as we'll talk about, it has claims of being misogynistic. And he has been accused of being misogynistic.
What? A surprise.
We are all shocked. Totally shocked.
In case y'all don't know what In the Company of Men is about, though, it's about two men, one of whom is played by Aaron Eckhart, who they're basically businessmen who decide to pull a prank on a deaf woman. Yes. by basically making her fall in love with them and making her think that they love her. And then just, you know, saying, ha, never mind.
Ghoster.
Yeah, it's really fucked up. But then he made Nurse Betty, which is a really funny dark comedy with Renee Zellweger. But he didn't write that one. So that might have been the key. Also important to note, he's a playwright. So In the Company of Men and his another movie of his, The Shape of Things, were both adapted from his plays.
It appears that his playwright status, like, though these days he's focusing on television and film, like, that is really his core. It's where he comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And you can definitely see that in the work that he's written in a lot of ways. I mean, like, I'm actually enthused to hear your thoughts on In the Company of Men, because I read the synopsis and I thought, this is a horrible movie written by a horrible person. And I was trying to find, like, some way that it wasn't, especially based on how he treats women in The Wicker Man.
Right.
And it just seemed pretty bad. So I dug into him a little bit more. He became a Mormon in college. Mm-hmm. And got a reputation for writing plays that were a bit saucier than his conservative religious university could handle.
Oh my God, can you imagine? Like, booted out of the Mormon university because you're writing too saucy a play?
Well, that didn't quite happen. They got to run, but some of them were, like, canceled after the first night or something. But he still was praised within that system. Eventually, after he'd moved on from the university, he did a play called Bash Latter-day Plays, mm-hmm. which is described as essentially good Latter-day Saints doing disturbing and violent things. Mm-hmm. This got him disfellowshipped from the Mormon church.
Right.
Which is, like, a step below excommunicated. So he wasn't, like, fully, like, exiled. But yeah, it's like, the next step down.
There's a critic named Daniel Kimmel who said of him, he is a misanthrope who assumes that only callous and evil people who use and abuse others can survive in this world.
That's definitely how In the Company of Men comes across, because that movie does end with the Aaron Eckhart character, who is the more despicable of the two protagonists, basically, like, getting promoted and having a happy life.
Yeah, triumphing. LaBute does a lot of work in the really despicable acts and sort of saying, like, this is humanity. This is what we are all about.
Well, what's interesting, I read, because I haven't seen The Shape of Things, and that's a movie with Rachel Weisz and Paul Rudd, but it seems to be kind of the same concept or similar concept to In the Company of Men, but it's a woman tricking a man into... Yes. Thinking that, you know, like Paul Rudd, that she loves him, but it's like she's doing it for a thesis project or something, which might be the twist of the movie. So spoilers, but that's what I gathered from it. But after The Shape of Things, his career's very weird. He did like that Samuel L. Jackson movie, Lakeview Terrace, where like he's a cop that moves next door to Patrick Wilson, but he's like a racist against white people. I mean, I've never seen it. But
talk about a movie premise that has not aged well. I don't even know that it was aged decently at the time, but like,
that sounds tone deaf, full stop.
Yeah. Well, I think he is tone deaf. But then, like, and I think this is 2007, he directed the remake of Death at a Funeral,
which is a dark comedy. So that's kind of on brand because it's like people behaving badly at a funeral.
Well, that's kind of my thing. I think he does better with dark comedy. Not to say, but it's not going to work. It's a very polarizing piece of work, which is why him doing this movie, The Wicker Man, is very perplexing. It's like, why do this?
Were there any answers as to that extremely critical question in the DVD commentary?
He said that this movie was birthed because Nicolas Cage wanted to remake it.
Yeah, it's a passion project for him.
Yes.
Nick.
And I don't remember if he said that Nicolas Cage approached him directly or if just like his people approached him directly. So yeah, this wasn't something that Neil LaBute set out to do from the get-go, but I guess they approached him and he was like, oh yeah, I want to do that. And he saw a lot of room for improvement in the original film or ways to update it.
Oh my gosh. Cool.
Well, Kappa, as you were suggesting, it doesn't really seem like Neil LaBute understood what the original film was, apart from this idea of a person being gaslit and then burned in effigy.
Like, that's that seems a very to be what he sharp took away. Description. I love that.
But, you know, whereas with the original, you have this devout Christian man, and it's about, you know, like religion versus paganism and how, like, he kind of deals with that. This movie very much, well, obviously excises that entire concept. And yeah, it's very much about a battle of the sexes, a man versus these women, which is a trait in his works. But it's, again, we'll talk about it, but it's like the women are all crazy.
Yeah. They take the leads, Summer's Isle, like Lord Summer's Isle or whatever they call Madam Summer's Isle. I don't forget what in this Wicker Man, the 2006
sister.
One. Sister Summer's Isle, yes.
Yes.
So Lord Summer's Isle, Christopher Lee in the original film, he is an occult leader. Occult.
Yeah.
But Sister Summer's Isle is a cult leader. There's there's a big difference. Like the way that things are operated there, there are systems within place within the society where people are not happy and they are suffering. Whereas in the original Wicker Man, that society is, for better or for worse, depending on how you view it, 100% okay. Mm-hmm. Everyone there wants to be there. They're here for it. And the whole, I mean, it's all quite twisted up. Something I do want to circle back to in terms of information and the DVD variations and the runtime variations is that there is a big difference, a huge difference between the unrated cut and the regular DVD edition, which is the one that I rented from Amazon, the only way I was able to get it because it's not in the streaming service right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's missing the famous Helmet of Bees scene. It's not
there. There's no bees. So disappointing. Yes. That's the version that I watch as well. And I was eagerly waiting for it.
So I know. So I bought the Blu-ray for this podcast. And the Blu-ray
don't
only...
Don't sound so proud of yourself, buddy.
The Blu-ray only comes the unrated version. But I had seen the theatrical version before. And so it was funny. And Joe and I were talking about this before that we recorded. But because I didn't remember the bee scene. So like, and I saw this movie years ago. And so when people kept talking about it, they were like, I was like, I don't, maybe I was drunk or something. And I just like fell asleep during the ending, which is highly likely. But I did remember the coda at the end with Jason Ritter and James Franco, which is not in the unrated cut.
Oh, yeah. Really?
Yeah.
Yes, I did read that. That seems like a weird excision. I don't know why you would cut that out.
Because it's the worst part of the film in terms of like filmmaking. It's boring and weird. I mean, like,
it's terribly acted. Yeah,
you do get to see you know, Harry Osborn and Dipper Pines awkwardly flirt with girls.
Yeah.
But like it's there's no tension there. It's dry and uncomfortable and weird. And then just like the final like ominous shot of, oh man, these ladies are trying to get these men so they can kill them.
Well, but that kind of defeats the purpose, though, because the whole purpose of them sacrificing Malus, Nicolas Cage, to the Wicker Man is to help their crop. So then by adding that coda, you're just saying, oh, no, they're just killing these people. Unless you're to infer that Nicolas Cage's sacrifices didn't work.
I always infer it as it's cyclical, so they need to have children ready to go to play this game out again in case the crops fail
at a later point. Because him and Willow dated like years before.
Yeah, like this is, you know, she said this has been a long, like this has been years in the work. Okay. We're getting so far into it. Do we want to finish this?
I mean, yeah, no. I mean, honestly, there's not a ton I'll bring up. I mean, honestly, it's just the cast of actresses mainly that
poor women who were suckered into this film. I feel so bad for them.
Oh, so dude, Lily Sobieski had to audition for this movie, and she auditioned for the role she got. And apparently they were, like, hesitant about her. Oh, no, because they had to have someone who was local to Vancouver where they were filming. And she was so desperate to be in this movie that she ran up to Neil LaBute after the audition and was like, oh, I'm actually just going to happen to be in Vancouver when y'all are shooting. I really want to do this. I'll do it for nothing.
Oh, God.
Ugh.
These are her words.
I really want to be in this movie. I need to be kicked by Nicolas Cage.
Well, yeah, okay, so we'll have a whole section on the unintentionally funny things in this movie, but I think it might, you know, fill up the whole podcast. So, yeah, you've got Nicolas Cage's Edward Malis. Edward is, of course, an homage to the actor who played the cop in the original movie. Ellen Burstyn as Sister Summer's Isle. Other random fact, though, it's Summer Isle in the original, Summer's Isle in the remake, and the only reason they changed it is because Neil LaBute thought it rolled off the tongue better.
It does not. Summer's Isle. It sounds like some kind of Ukrainian, yeah, like musical instrument.
So, yeah, you've got Ellen Burstyn as Sister Summer's Isle, who appears 62 minutes into this movie. And then your cast of women. So, well, I mean, not that Ellen Burstyn isn't a woman, obviously, like, but she's like, you know, barely a factor. You've got Kate Bien as Willow Woodward, who is Nicolas Cage's baby mama. Spoiler alert. And then Lily Sobieski as Sister Honey, Molly Parker as Sister Rose and Sister Thorn, which, by the way, I did not realize that she plays twins in this movie.
It's because the one twin is glimpsed for a hot second and that's it.
Well, that was a subplot that apparently, like, Willow was gonna have a twin that was revealed in the climax of the movie as well, so it was gonna be like, oh, you never knew, like, which one was talking to him, but they dropped it
because it's stupid as fuck.
Yeah. And then you've got Frances Conroy, who we all love from Six Feet Under and American Horror Story, as the random Dr. Moss, and Diane Delano. I'm going to say Delano, as Sister Beach, a.k.a. the barkeep.
Barmaid.
Oh, barmaid. Barmaid. Yeah. Apologies. Yeah, so that's that. And by all means, call them by their name or their character name. I don't care.
Well, they're so, you know, easy to remember because they're all named after plants. Because that's another thing that exists in this movie.
So where do y'all want to start? Like, by dig in, but where do you want to start?
How about a plot recap?
Oh, sorry.
It's like Trace has never done this before.
It's because I'm not drinking. Go ahead.
All right. Bear with me. I tried to be brief, and it just ended up getting longer and longer because I wanted to include so much random shit.
Go ahead.
Okay. So Edward Malis from California, as he frequently introduces himself, is a healthy eating police officer on medical leave from a pre-title car accident in which a little girl and her mother are bulldozed by a semi. This is a recurring image that happens throughout the film. The plot kicks in when Edward receives a letter from his ex-fiancée Willow, Kate Bierhar. She's asking for his help to find her missing daughter Rowan on an isolated and private community of Summer's Isle in the Pacific Northwest. The Isle's predominantly female pagan population, all of whom are named after plants, are less than welcoming. In fact, they are openly hostile, refuse answers to simple questions, and often fail to understand common language. After revealing he's allergic to bees, this will be important, Edward reconnects with Willow in the woods. Later, he discovers that his therapeutic tapes are missing from his bag. This is not important. And he overhears Sister Beach discussing the return of the Wicker Man. After an extended sequence in a barn that serves no purpose, Edward learns that the island's crop of honey was cursed and the island is host primarily to women, several of whom are pregnant. After a heated confrontation with Rowan's Aryan classmates, Sister Rose, Molly Parker, the teacher, infers that Rowan is dead. Rowan is, unsurprisingly, not dead and is, in fact, actually Edward's daughter. After a nonsensical series of hallucinations, he breaks into Dr. Moss's, Francis Conroy's, home to discover the missing Harvest Festival photo, which kind of comes to nothing, and read about the burnt offering sacrifice required in the Festival of Fertility. After nearly dying in a bee-related accident, I told you it was important, he interviews Sister Summer Isle, Evelyn Bernstein. After another near-fatal accident, Edward runs around town assaulting women and children before he realizes his search for Rowan is a trap. He is overpowered, has his legs broken, this is unclear depending on which cut you're watching, is stung by bees, and then burned to death in effigy in a giant wicker man. 6 months later, with plentiful honey, the next cycle begins as James Franco and Jason Ritter are picked up in a bar for breeding purposes by Willow and Honey.
Joe, it's Ellen Burstyn. There's no, it's not Bernstein Bears.
No, I will continue to call her Ellen Bernstein.
Okay, now where do y'all want to start?
Well, having said all that, I would like to, for people who are not aware, assert the plot of the 1973 original. And I do this because in talking about, oh, I'm going to be on this podcast, people are like, wait, there was one before the 2006 one? And I'm like, oh, no.
Oh, no.
This is not okay. I mean, I don't know if that's going to be the key demographic of this podcast. Probably not. But let's just err on the side of caution. It's 1973. The summer of love has ended. And hippies have converged in interesting ways. The practices of the old are culminating in this mid-20th century mixing pot where we have a sort of new lease on life for the occult and witchcraft practices in the world. Depending on how you interpret this, this is either spooky and cool and sexy or scary and bad. And for Christians, it's super duper scary and bad. So in this story, a police officer, in this case named Neil Howie, gets a letter addressed to him saying that a young girl, Rowan, again, has disappeared, and he needs to come out to Summer Isle, this remote island in Scotland. Not
Washington.
Yeah. So he goes there, a lone British cop on this island. They're like, can't come here. This is a restricted place. He does anyway. And there he finds a kind of pagan utopia, at least within certain systems anyway. There's all these bizarre and quirky and fun practices like getting rid of a sore throat by popping a frog in your mouth and then taking it out, and the frog has the burden of the sore throat now, or just open fornication at nighttime, or the barkeeper's daughter named Willow. That's Willow in this story, and she's basically an avatar of the goddess Aphrodite and makes love with all the men of the village, and there are offerings regularly made to her. But it's not in any kind of like, she's not perceived as a harlot. She's actually like a powerful walking fertility goddess. And though men are salacious around her, it's a positive ecosystem where she's well accepted. In fact, all the women on this island are sex positive in every which way. Aside from the fact this all culminates in a conspiracy to kill the police inspector, this is actually kind of a weird little utopia. And it's run by Christopher Lee's character, who's the descendant of a scientist who came out there to grow apples on this volcanic soil. Unfortunately, the apple crop has gone bad, and they are using the May Festival, which involves the crowning of the May Queen and a laddie and Punch the Jester and this whole procession to do all this thing. So this is a great detective film. It's a great suspense film. And where it gets credit as a horror film, I feel, comes from people who strongly identify with the Christian themes and view the pagan practices here as zealotry that leads to a man's death as he's burned in effigy for the renewal of the harvest and has been conned the whole time. And let me tell you, I'm ruining it for you right now, but the degree to which he was conned and like how it was all a setup, it's done in such a smooth way that's really quite admirable in terms of like detective stories and so on.
It is, whereas like in the remake, you have the women that are practically twirling their non-existent mustaches.
Yes.
Well, and their plot makes absolutely no sense. Like, Bernstein actually says in the climax of this new film, she says, you know, we had this meticulously plotted out, everybody played their parts, and you're thinking, bitch, that doesn't make any sense at all, because everything that happens in this film seems to be happening by coincidence.
I didn't really get it. I got it, but it doesn't. And all the women, like, everyone played their part. It's like, what were they doing? Like, Lily Sobieski is standing there holding an axe in one scene and just giggling like a little girl. Okay, the barmaid is there.
And there are creepy twins. Oh no, creepy twins. Yes! Never explained.
Yeah, like you almost need. I mean, I hate it in these kinds of puzzle films where we, as the audience, are meant to identify with the main character and there's a mystery to be unraveled. And usually what ends up happening is we'll get some kind of wraparound device where it's kind of like, well, here's what you were seeing, but this is what was actually happening. Like, when he was listening and the creepy twins were talking about the return of the Wicker Man the next day, they had actually known that he was listening, and that's why they set up this conversation or something like that. But there's no suggestion that anyone ever actually knows what he knows. Like, he just seems to be constantly running around screaming for Rowan and, like, punching people.
Hey, Joe and I are not anti-remake, like, but we actually talk about a lot about how we enjoy particular remakes. Not recently, because we also talked about Pet Sematary this week, but but the changes, like, to me, a remake needs to be, like, you know, you take something that maybe is flawed or it hasn't aged particularly well, and you update it for modern times, and or try to improve on what you think is wrong. I don't know what Neil Levy thought was wrong with the first movie, but the changes in this just don't, like, from apples to honey, you know? He was trying to make it, you know, oh, it's like a colony of bees, which are what the women are, and actually they have their queen bee, but it's
and
also
the men are drones.
Yes. And well, and so hey, here's my thought, and maybe y'all can disagree. I think that Neil LaBute has been maybe burned by a woman or two, and the way that he writes the women treating the men in this movie is how he feels women have treated him his whole life. That's what I think.
Oh, like, yeah, for sure. Except that in this case, it's probably he feels that he's been burned by women, but in fact, he's just a cretin.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And so, yeah, that's his yeah. take on it, his hot take.
Yeah, like, he is the Nicolas Cage character in this, where he is righteous. He's doing the good, like, the correct thing, and everyone is just, you know, gaslighting him, lying to him, treating him poorly, getting in his way, and you're just like, no, dude, like, look at this performance. It's like Nicolas Cage is obviously batshit crazy in this role, and that's one of the reasons people love the film. But, like, the writing of this character, he is so, like, he's such a hypocrite.
So here's the thing, though. So it's so funny. As much of an asshole as LaBute probably is, it doesn't seem like he's a very he's good at directing his actors, because he even talks about in the commentary how there were things, like, Nicolas Cage would be like, oh, I think I should just do this, and they would scrap pages from the script because Cage said, oh, well, I think my character would do this, and Neil LaBute would just be like, all right, and they just let him go.
Well, Cage is credited as a producer.
Yeah, and he was arguably he is still to this day far more famous than LaBute. So he probably had a lot more control on this set than LaBute did.
One interesting factor in between, like, the comparisons between the two films and the role of Edward Malice is that Neil Howey, the inspector from the first film, he's not a likable guy.
No.
To find him relatable, you have to be a special kind of person who's not gonna, like, well, by the end of this film, I'm like, yeah, he's awful. Burn him. Like, he's getting a martyr's death. You guys have done everything right. If you genuinely believe that human sacrifice is a worthy thing to do at this moment, you've chosen the right person. No, you've canvassed him. No one's going to miss him. And he is getting exactly what he wants, being such a devout follower of the Church of England.
Yeah.
No matter how he pleads.
Because he's a religious hypocrite in that film.
Yeah.
And, like, that's when I was watching the original, I was like, this guy's a jerk, and he's judging these people based on their religion, or I guess paganism, if you want to call it that. And, like, I kind of was okay when he died. Whereas, well, sorry, not okay with him dying, but, like, I don't know. I just didn't like him. Whereas Nicolas Cage is just like, it's just funny.
Yeah. I mean, they seem to want you to be on Malice's side. But you can only be on his side if you also happen to hate women.
Well, because in the original, there's no reason for him to go to this island or be so connected except that he gets sent that anonymous letter. Whereas in this one, they add in the connection that, you know, it's his daughter. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean,
on the down low secret. Surprise, Nick.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. I will say,
because women will do that.
Women will
just, like, have your baby and won't tell you, and then they'll, like, use you for a blood sacrifice.
Their long con, but I will say, I do like the fact that it's his daughter that basically, like, sets him on fire.
the last very bit of this movie, and I'm not talking about Dipper Pines and Harry Osborn,
right.
is actually pretty good. That when the head of the Wicker Man collapses, it's a cool perspective shot, having the daughter be the one to light the flame like that, and having the context of it being his daughter, that's cool. And even the bee helmet thing, that's super weird and actually kind of original and interesting. I don't know why they do it exactly, but it's neat.
So he said that it was supposed to be an example of the bees giving their sacrifice, because when a bee stings, I believe it dies, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, so that was the mentality behind it. But man, do those CGI bees look bad. Like, it didn't even look good in 2006. Like, it looked bad.
Yeah, there's, oh gosh, this is such a mess. So we've been talking about Malice, and we've been saying his name a lot. It's important to note also about that name that it is male and phallus mashed together.
Yes.
Wow. What depth, Neil.
Well, because this movie also excises a lot of the phallic symbolism and imagery that the first one had and replaces it with baby fetuses in a jar.
Yeah, because we haven't seen that from like a Texas Chainsaw Massacre standpoint.
Yes.
Or like that to me is one of those things where you go, oh, LeBute doesn't understand horror films. So he thinks throwing a fetus into a honey jar is going to be absolutely terrifying. And then we're going to throw in the loudest fucking musical score that we can find just in case no one's certain how to feel.
That is something I missed from the original was the folk music. Like the first one's kind of a musical and I really enjoyed all the songs. And then
it is straight up a music horror film. It's incredible.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And then this one is just like, oh, it's a horror score from, again, Cap, as you know, from the composer of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, Angelo Badalamenti. And it's fine, but not actively good. It's far, far, far from his best work. I mean, he's done all kinds of cool stuff like City of Lost Children. That was also him. But yeah, this ain't it.
Well, I think it's just it's
generic.
It is generic, but it's also, it's used so poorly. It's like they crank up the sound on it just to make sure that you know what to feel. And it's overwhelming. A score is meant to guide you, but it shouldn't be the thing that you notice in a particular scene. I just found it, like, I found it so overbearing watching this movie. I kept thinking that I had sat on my remote and accidentally turned up the sound.
Oh my God. I actually had a question about the beginning of the film. So, you know, they give him this...
Oh, please.
They give him this backstory. Like, well, kind of. It's a backstory, but it takes place, like, I want to say a week before, like, the events of the film, like, actually kick into place.
I think it's supposed to be a couple of months. Like, he's been on the pills, he's been off work, and everybody misses him.
So, yeah, he fails to save this mother and daughter from a car explosion. But I was really perplexed by the child in the car, who's just sitting there as the car goes up in flames.
Everything about this car sequence suggests that it's like a plot thread that is not picked up because the whole thing is under mysterious circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mother and a daughter in the car, and the daughter is belligerently causing trouble. There seems to be some kind of distress. You wonder if maybe they're escaping to a cult of some kind or escaping from a cult or something weird is happening
right.
That it ties back into the main plot.
Yeah.
And then eventually she throws the doll into the road and the truck then swerves out of the way from, oh, I can't hit this man in the road who's picking up this doll, and instead hits the station wagon and explodes. But then they go on to say, the bodies were never found. We don't know if they ever will be found. Like, ooh, mysterious. So that must be important, right? It's not.
And so, yeah, that's the thing. And then they keep giving him all these flashbacks. Oh, it's not good, but I love when he's on that ferry and he sees the girl, and then, like, the truck comes and just, like, sideswipes her on the ferry.
The stupidest fucking visual in the entire movie. And it happens twice.
More commentary tidbits. It was supposed to be bees surrounding her. And then they were like, well, how would he know to, like, foreshadow bees? It should be from his past. So they did the truck instead.
Oh, my God.
They're leaning so hard in the truck thing, and it's just, I mean, every part of this film is confused or broken.
I took it to be, like, they're obviously trying to anticipate the daughter drama that is to come. And, you know, the girl looks very similar to Rowan. The doll looks very similar to the doll that he finds later. So
How to get burned!
Oh my God. Yeah, and I think part of this too, and I don't know if it's a drop plot line because it does happen so frequently that it kind of feels like maybe they thought that was enough, but I think we're also meant to believe that, like, we're meant to question what's happening on the island as, is he actually a crazy pill addict and he's just, like, out of his mind? But it's always so obvious that, like, he is having some hallucinations, and those are the result of the pill, but that everything else is actually happening.
Well, that's something that I was always like, yeah, because it seems to set up that, you know, he is an unreliable protagonist. You know, you don't know if whatever he's thinking is real. Is he paranoid? Like, what's going on? And since the film has become a laughingstock of everything, Nicolas Cage has gone on to say that, you know, oh, him and he and Neil LaVie were making a black comedy. They were taking this classic horror film and making a black comedy.
Yeah, nice try.
He said specifically an absurdist comedy.
Yes, but again, you listen to that commentary with Neil LaBute, and it's clear he does not feel that way.
Everyone in this is clearly, like, taking it very seriously. And honestly, like, I do genuinely love Cage's performance, even unironically, if you can look at it from him being, like, he's an asshole police officer, and that's generally, he's kind of weird, you don't know where he's coming from. But if you think about him as an unhinged man who's so, you know, crazy, he'll storm this island based on this weirdly worded letter from an ex.
And also claim that he has the authority to, like, break into people's houses and to ransack their belongings and question them.
He's a cop from California. I mean.
Yeah, like, who's on medical leave from what we can tell. Like, he's not actually even an active cop.
Like, if you can read him as being, like, a man unhinged, like, then every single crazy reaction or line he has is well within character, and Cage is playing it magnificently. It's the least stiff performance of the entire film.
Oh, yeah. I read a couple of reviews where people said, you know, his performance is obviously unhinged, but it feels like everybody else is sleepwalking.
Yes.
Well, I don't know. Do you think that was the actresses, or do you think that's Neil LaBute saying, act lifeless like all you women are in real life?
Oh, my God. He's like, I was told by SAG that I had to hire real human beings. I couldn't use cardboard cutouts, but I want you to act like those cardboard cutouts.
Well, because honestly, I don't think Lily Sobieski, I love her. I love all of her movies, but I think that she isn't the strongest actress. And so she was just playing how she always plays in this movie. But everyone else, yeah. I mean, even Frances Conroy, who's generally, like, such a treat to watch, is just kind of like, meh, I'm a doctor. Oh, I also take photographs.
Yeah, like, compare this performance to hers in Catwoman. And I mean, at least she looks like she's having fun, you know, doing her Stevie Nicks cosplay in Catwoman. Here it's like, oh, I'm just going to step out. I've got some fetuses in jars in the back if you want to take a look. I will say, and maybe it's just the Canadian connection, but I kind of like Molly Parker's, like, uber bitch performance. She's Miss Rose, the school teacher.
Yeah. The problem is none of these women have a lot to do. They each get one, like, scene before the ending. And yeah, I will agree. I think Molly Parker, I mean, she gets, I guess, two scenes because there's one in the classroom and then there's one outside the classroom immediately afterwards. But yeah, she's fine. She's fine.
She has an opportunity to have a little bit of fire in her, and that's good. Noticeably an improvement, but also the lines she's delivering are bad.
Oh, yeah. Okay, can we talk about the classroom scene? Because I fucking love... Okay, so Cap, you already referenced the fact that his name, his literal name, is a combination of male phallus, but then I love that he walks into that classroom, and the, like, our introduction to this new character, and literally all I could think of was this Aryan society of girls. Like, because they're all white, they're all blonde, they're all, like, extremely tanned from working the land. I was just like, what is happening here? But yeah. I love that it's like, okay, so, you know, what do we think of when we think of men? Like, male phallus. So I get that line reading wrong.
I don't know, but I do love in that classroom scene, though, and this is a Cage line, but it's just so funny when he finds out that, you know, they're all lying, and he goes, "You little liars, Rowan Woodward is your classmate, isn't she?" And he turns to Molly Parker and just goes, "And you're the biggest liar of them all, Sister Rose."
Now, serious question. He says at one point when he's going through the desk, he says, "Sorry, you're going to have to bear with me." Do we think that's foreshadowing to the fact that he's going to put on a bear costume at the climax?
Oh, snap.
Man, I didn't catch that, but you're right.
Well, I mean, with the visionary writer behind this, there's no coincidences. This is written like a steel trap.
Okay, so is this the only is this the only Neil LaBute written film that y'all have seen?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. I would recommend that you go check out something that he's written just to compare, because this script is a hot mess of dialogue. I mean, it's like he's writing a soap opera.
Yeah. I mean, I'm extra interested now to know whether some of the more ridiculous stuff is actually from Nick Cage, maybe ad-libbing. I don't think that excuses, you know, things like the flashback sequences that we've talked about where they just don't make any sense, and they're not well integrated into the film. Like, my favorite is the hallucination when he goes to find the man who flies the plane, and he just sits on the dock for seemingly 4 or 5 hours, and then he thinks he sees Rowan under some kind of fish trap, so he dives into the water, pulls her out, and then she disappears. He wakes back up on the dock, and then suddenly she's in his arms, and then he wakes back up a second time and just goes, "God damn it!"
Well, and that's the movie's attempt at a cheap jump scare, and so that's why it's like, this man doesn't know how horror movies work, or he doesn't know how good horror movies work, because every attempted scare in this film isn't scary. That's why there's a crow in the desk instead of, you know, a beetle on a string like in the original in the classroom, because he's like, oh, we wanted to, like, scare the audience.
Like, crows are, I guess, scary. I don't know. There is no tension building that happens throughout this whole thing.
Absolutely not.
It's such a shame. Like, it seems like a reasonable premise that anyone should be able to do, of just like, well, it's an investigation, so how can you not let that build? But they just, because it's so detestably orchestrated that at every end, you're just looking at being like, oh, wait, no, this doesn't make sense. Why are you doing this? This smells funny from the get-go. Like, for example, the letter that Willow writes him is worded and scripted in this bizarre, stilted language that's like archaic. When he meets her, she's totally normal. She's the one who's explaining city slang to all these country folk.
Yeah. I wrote in my notes in all caps, holy shit, her handwriting is exquisite. Because
oh, yeah. She's got the best calligraphy I've ever seen.
Not lots to do there on Summer's Isle.
Sister Rose, you must teach me your handwriting secrets.
This movie also does the thing that a lot of mid-2000s movies do when they make sure to announce, oh, there's no cell phone service on this island, so that you know that there's an excuse for him to not use his cell phone.
And then we still get 3 different scenes where he tries to use it.
He's not smart.
So I did keep track of words that he doesn't know how to use throughout the film, just for like shits and giggles. So when he approaches the pilot initially, he says, ahoy, to which the man then says, what? Just say hello. He calls Sister Beach barmaid, which she does not understand. He doesn't understand the difference between tomorrow and the day of tomorrow.
Oh, that was weird.
Really, so like, it's a 30-second conversation in this hour and 40-minute long movie. And he also doesn't understand what quixotic means.
Yeah. A question for y'all. In the theatrical version, does he discover the pilot's, like, mutilated corpse in a boat?
He does.
Okay.
He does. And the pilot is, like, arbitrarily missing a hand and something else.
Something's up with his eyes.
Like, yes.
I mean,
his mouth is sewed shut or something.
Yes, because, remember, he wasn't meant to talk.
That's the thing. In the first movie, it's just the sacrifice. They're not crazy murderers.
Yeah, it's, I mean, and this whole premise of the colony and these women being like, you know, the queens and the regular like bees, whereas the men are drones. They maybe have their tongues cut out or something. Mm-hmm. But it really, like, it's an interesting idea that's done so terribly because it's done specifically for the purpose of misogyny.
Yes.
Like, drones, they have no stingers, they don't collect nectar or pollen, their only purpose is to fertilize the queen. That's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
That's like, that's not a bad thing at all. If, like, for example, in the original Wicker Man, if your only, like, duty was to, like, live a healthy life and knock boots with Willow, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, no, I mean, all the colony members were very nice and very sweet, whereas in this one, all of them are super off-putting and, like, not warm people.
Well, and I think, again, this is another example of, oh, I'm making a horror film, so I need to have my entire cast acting shady, acting creepy, having these men refuse to speak, having them look like they're constantly looking away, they won't make eye contact, all these women have nefarious plots and stuff. Like, it's just so obviously, like, I read a horror screenwriting 101 book that said, make everyone a suspect.
An interesting thing that also happens is there is one other female character in this film, and that's a female police officer who's genuinely a friend to Malice.
Yeah.
And just to make sure that once he gets to the island, you know that women are ominous and bad. he has a hallucination where it's a flashback to her being in his house, being kind to him, and she turns into a pile of bees.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hint, hint. Women are bees. Bees are bad. Bees will kill you.
I have a bee EpiPen. Specifically bee EpiPen.
It's called bee epi.
Don't worry. Bee epi.
Oh my God. Love it.
So that's one thing where I will give this film credit and I will give Neil credit. This bee thing, he uses it to dastardly effect, but it is actually interesting. Mm-hmm. It comes out of nowhere. Like, mm-hmm. this is his or Cage's project, this whole bee thing. There's a scene where there's some background beekeeper ladies that you see sort of scattered throughout later portions of the film. They have these black hoods on, these red dresses. They have these bee smokers that are these larger than they should be bellows, with a little like smoke tank attached to them. Mm-hmm. And they've got these straps on them. They're hanging low. They're like using these bee smokers. The art direction is really good. They look like AK-47s.
Yeah.
It's super cool. And then when Cage is out in the bee fields, like there's an aerial shot of all these little like
bee houses.
Yeah, and they have in the grass is cut in honeycomb patterns. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating. There's an upstairs room in the sister's house that's got these like, you know, honeycombed hexagon windows.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
And even like her bed when we see her, like when he's going through the house and he keeps seeing like men with bee stings and women covered in bees, and then he just leaves. But then they cut to a shot of Sister Summer Isle, and she's just like majestically laid out in that bed, and she's surrounded by her own drones. Like, she's obviously the queen bee, and the color scheme is the same. And yeah, there's interesting ideas here that you're just like, well, what the fuck? Where is that movie?
Well, I think the costume design is very good. And this is not because the costume designer had like three lines in the commentary. But I also think it's very well shot. And speaking of your Canadian pride, Joe, because the cinematographer, his biggest credit is for The Sweet Hereafter, which you have discussed before in this podcast.
I have. That's a callback to our Dead Ringers episode.
But yeah, no, like, that aerial shot, and there was one other aerial shot that I thought was actually very pretty. So, I mean, there's competence behind the camera in this movie. It's just not in the correct places.
Well, I would argue the film is falling down in the two sections that Neil LaBute is responsible, and then Cage is just, he's honestly in a completely different film. And I think the reason people like this movie is because this is the start of Nicolas Cage's wacky, crazy, batshit performance period.
Are you sure about that? Have you seen Vampire's Kiss?
I have not, admittedly.
Well, it's late 80s, and It is actually the key, the Rosetta Stone that unlocked Nicolas Cage for me. I saw how everything he does is totally intentional, and he's a visionary.
Really?
because that performance is the most crazy thing you will ever see in a million years. And it never, ever should have been done that way. But he said, no, I'm going to do it this way. And let's see someone try and fucking stop me.
But it sounds like that one actually works.
I think this one works, too. That's why it's the only thing we're talking about.
Yeah, you think the performance works, everything else in the film doesn't.
I'm going to politely disagree. I do not think this performance works. I think it's hilarious, but I don't think it works.
Had the movie been different, I think it would work. But I think because it's so tonally different from everything else that this movie's trying to do, that's the part that doesn't work.
I mean, his line deliveries are quite a thing of majesty, though. Especially when he's just yelling at people. Like, it really is something to behold.
That's something, too, and because when he's, you know, the end of the movie, he's calling them bitches, you murderous bitches, blah, blah, blah.
God.
Killing me won't bring back your damn honey.
Which, that line doesn't bother me, because in the original, the guy says something that's like, you know, killing me won't bring back your apples or something. So it's kind of similar. But instead of calling these people bitches, because it's men and women, obviously, he's citing the Bible. He's reading, like, Psalms, and it's true to the character. But then, yeah, then you have fucking Malice just going, you bitches, you bitches, you murderous bitches!
Well, but that's the key distinction between these two films. One is a religious, investigation about, like, a hypocrite and a pagan society that Cap, as you mentioned, was terrifying to some people at the time. Whereas this just dials it down to like men versus women. Like this film is a weird battle of the sexes for no reason.
But it's such an uneven playing ground just because it's not told from an unbiased perspective. This movie clearly does not like women.
No.
And so that's the problem.
Yeah.
Like the bitches.
But it takes on, like, it seems so much more malicious as opposed to, like, he could have called them whores. He could have called them harlots. He could have called them, you know, like any terrible things. But instead, like, he went directly for that thing that, like, misogynists go for.
I was actually surprised. So, because that this was a PG-13 movie. Not because, what we see should be rated R, but because of the man that wrote and directed this and that it is a horror movie it's based on a movie that was already rated R. Why tone it down? But all the sexuality and the sexuality, there wasn't really any violence in the first one. It's really, I think the first one was just rated R for the nudity and the sex. But yeah. But I'm surprised that for a 2006 horror remake, it doesn't like swing for the fences. And apparently it was originally rated R, but they cut shit out, including the B scene and the leg breaking. But I think there was more to make it PG-13. So would there have been more female, male-on-female violence, maybe, in the original cut?
Or would it have, like, maybe he would have killed some of them, as opposed to just, like, you know, comically kicking and punching them.
You know what I really wanted? So he has a gun, because he's a cop from California. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's a scene where he gets bitten by bees, and he blacks out, and he wakes up, and you see him pick up his gun, and then you're like, oh, boy, he should check his clip, and he doesn't. No. And then eventually, surprise, surprise, he doesn't have...
He's been betrayed by Willow.
Yeah, she conveniently she was keeping the ammo in her pocket just so she could hold it up dramatically and drop it down. But I would have loved it. Would have been so good. And this is where I would have been like, oh, movie, you got yourself. If he fired that gun and a bee just came out of it, I want that so bad.
I was actually super disappointed with that reveal. Like it, I mean, I don't know if we. I don't know that I care to talk about whether or not this film succeeds if you've seen the original. Like, if none of us had seen the 70s version, would we look at this and be like, this is a really interesting story and blah, blah, blah? I don't think so.
No, because I saw this movie years ago before having ever seen the original, and I still didn't think it was good.
Okay. But I do find, you know, this film is so obviously misogynistic and pointed against women that I'm really genuinely surprised that at the end, when Willow reveals that she's been in on the plan the whole time, I'm genuinely shocked that she isn't like dripping with malice and like cackling and holding it over him. Like, she looks sedated, and that has never played well with me. Like, it's such a boring choice.
It becomes less of a reveal. Her compliance, it was very strange. I felt odd about that whole thing too. I was waiting for something to happen that would be interesting, but nothing interesting happened.
But that's kind of the thing that is, I mean, again, not to just to compare it to the original, you know, it's not these mustache twirling people. It's like there's something off and it's unsettling, but you don't quite know what's going on, and it kind of builds that dread. Whereas this one, it's like clearly from the get-go these women are all bonkers. Yeah. And that's where all the suspense is lost. And so, but yeah, I guess I can see that your point, Joe, is, yeah, why doesn't she do something more interesting with that reveal?
I mean, maybe it's because they know that they're building to the effigy. And really, like, when you think Wicker Man, for lack of any other thing, you're going to think of a man burning to death inside a giant, like, wicker statue. So I wonder if part of it was just like, well, who cares? Like, we know we're going to get him into it anyway, so it doesn't really matter if people hold it over him or whatever. But I do think by not having any of that tension or any of that dread, the whole confrontation where, you know, they're just pontificating about, oh, this is how we did this. We got you here. Everybody's been in on it the whole time. You're like, yeah. Get to the burning.
It really, like, it does really, again and again, raise the question of why did they make this? And it seems like such a fruitless thing, because if you look at the original film, no matter who you are, you can say, this is an art film. It's super unusual. A musical horror film is not a common thing. No. And this is, the you look at the original film, I don't have anything to compare it to. it stands alone.
Yeah.
And you think, all right, so here's what we're going to do. We're going to get Nick Cage and we're going to try to do a somewhat conventional horror suspense film based on this thing that was an art film. An art film that is, by all definitions, a cult film.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, the brand recognition is negligible at best.
I mean, that's never stopped Hollywood before, but...
True.
Because you're also getting something that's not American and making it American. So, I mean, there's that.
I just think it's so funny, like, so this whole thing was part of this master plan that all of these women had different roles to play in. So they were directing his actions around the island this entire time. Like... why didn't they just knock him out when he got to the island and then he wakes up and they're like, by the way, like, I recognize that she says you had to come to this willingly, but it's like he came to the island willingly. That's enough. In the original, it feels like they're showing him a way of life and they're confronting him.
Yeah.
So that at the end he realizes like, well, I'm a fucking idiot and I got myself into this situation. Whereas in this film, it's just like, we lured you to this island and then dicked you around for 2 days, and now we're going to roast you like a marshmallow.
Well, no, because they give him those four reasons in the original. It's like, you had to come of your own accord, you had to be a fool, and there were two others, and it made sense why they had to wait to, like, make this happen.
And they had to test how virginal he truly was.
Yes.
Like, because that, again, that plays so well into this idea of, like, a religious parable, right? Like, you're confronting hypocrites on their values. Whereas in this film, like, by not having that, by just making it a gendered thing, it's just like all of that ends up getting lost.
The idea of, okay, like, let's not make it about religious confrontations and make it about like a battle of the sexes. I like the concept of that. The problem is the movie doesn't give both sides equal playing field. And that's the main failure just thematically for me.
Yeah, that's very fair.
I think the closest we get actually is the conversation that he has with Sister Summer Isle when he first meets her out in the garden.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that you're so distracted by him swiping at bees the whole fucking time that you can't even pay attention when she's talking about how she is like the physical embodiment of this archetype on Earth. And, you know, that's why the island is run in a certain way.
Do y'all think LaBute knows or understands his misogyny, or do you think he's unaware?
I think he thought he was saying something interesting about the sexes, but this could only be done by someone who's extremely unaware, I feel.
To me, that's more dangerous than someone who is aware.
Sure.
It's an interesting question, and Cap, I'm sorry, I'm going to do this to you. Trace, keep that question in mind for a film in a couple of weeks that we're going to discuss, because there's a film coming up that plays men versus women, and it's from a male director's point of view about shit he was going through in his personal life, and I'm interested to revisit that question at a later date.
I will forget that, but sure, okay.
I'll bring it up.
Yeah.
Here's what I'd like to do. I think that we should remake this Wicker Man, but like do it as much as the other Wicker Man was remade, which is as to say, like, not really at all.
Yeah.
But just keep what works about it. So keep the B stuff.
Yes.
Because mm-hmm. there's B horror, and not letter B horror, but B horror.
Yeah. Like literal B horror.
Yeah. It's a small but weirdly existent horror genre.
Mm-hmm.
Like Candyman, The Deadly Bees, The Savage Bees, The Swarm, and of course, My Girl.
And don't forget, ripped from the headlines, bees living in a woman's eyeball and feeding on her tears.
So I feel like there's a sexy occult movie about women and bees that can be made. And like, this has really got my gears turning. I want a horror film that can retain the interesting bee iconography and tap into an occult vibe, but a healthy occult vibe.
Yeah.
Not an exploitative, like, witches and the feminine are spooky and evil cliche. So like, I've been racking my brain all afternoon trying to think, like, what does this movie look like? And the easiest version, the most conventional version that I got is like, there's some sort of male authority figures or would-be authority figures who unwittingly end up amidst a matriarchal society that they don't understand. And they proceed to panic in short time, fundamentally harming someone or something quite important and sacred to that society.
Mm.
So the audience is potentially on the male side because they don't know entirely what they saw either. But as the film goes on, it becomes clear that the male characters are worthy of the justice being dispensed. And that any revulsion towards the bee people was simply a knee-jerk reaction to the other and the unknown. Not everything different is wrong, you know? Like, so when some horror is dealt to these people, there's a sense of restorative balance that doesn't smack of typically masculine solutions in these cases. Like, to bring balance, this needs to be a film that that attacks, like, patriarchal worldviews, enacting both retribution and love as a justice for male wrongdoings.
To be honest, that actually sounds to me more like a fantasy film.
Well, but that's a good way to do a remake, though, is to, like, kind of change the genre that you're doing a little bit. I also think it might be, and this is probably super cliche now to do it, but to make your protagonist a female.
I suppose so. I mean, I was thinking about that as well. And I have like, that's the most conventional, like, horror film framework that I came up with.
Right.
Then my mind started wandering down some stranger, weirder, more Wicker Man, but not the plot of Wicker Man kind of vibes about, like, children and indoctrination and fantasy societies. And, like, again, always the horror of the unknown, but the unknown that actually is quite beautiful, but people don't understand it, which is... Mm-hmm. Kind of indicative of the queer experience in many cases.
Yeah. It's interesting because that almost has, like, Lovecraftian vibes. Although, of course, we all know that Lovecraft was the embodiment of human shit in real
life. Yeah, like, wasn't he, like, a terrible person?
Yep, he was a racist and a sexist and potentially a closeted gay man. But, yeah, he's awful. He's an awful person.
Great!
But his narratives were often interesting because they were often that fish out of water, like, you know, stumbling into a community of people that they don't understand. Like, I'm thinking of, like, Dagon or those other kinds of stories. But there'd be an interesting opportunity to do something along the lines of, you think that you know better or that you are in the right, and it's only by, like, immersing yourself and getting to know these people that you recognize that you're intruding on theirs.
Yeah, that's what I feel that, like, okay, so obviously it's been stated that I deal in Lovecraftian fiction, and also recently stated I have big problems with the man himself, H.P. Lovecraft. Mm-hmm. And I rectify this by the fact that Lovecraftian horror has fundamentally shaped our pop culture for the better, because it's quite interesting.
Yes.
Because Lovecraft, in his extreme fears of the unknown, of things he didn't understand, of himself perhaps, he tapped into a way of writing about scope and scale and obscurity that no one had done before, that continues to mystify. But where there are problems is where we have adopted that style and it's grown stagnant and does not grow anymore. That people of color and queer themes don't necessarily have a place in that ecosystem, or fundamentally that you can, I believe you can do unknowable horror and have it not, and have it be, like, also have it contain themes of, like, of love and affection and of being able to see the other side to it. So, I mean, that's just, it's an inevitability that when I write stories, this sort of stuff happens, because that's where my head's been for months now. But yeah, like, there's a lot of work that has been done, not just my own, but by other people who see the potential for what would say in some cases would be body horror or horror of the unknown, and make it sexy and beautiful and fundamentally queer. And I love that stuff. That's where I live.
And Trace and I are always on board with, like, hey, is there a way that we could shoehorn some queerness into here, or some diversity into this? Like,
well, yeah, because then, I mean, we'd have more movies to cover, too.
I don't know. I mean, I'm thinking, like, let's do the two guys who did The Endless. But I'm thinking, like Spring. Like, Spring is kind of what you're talking about, Cap, only it's a pretty conventional, quote-unquote, heterosexual romance.
But it's so good.
It's so good, though. And part of the reason that it works... Oh, you should check it out. It's pretty good.
It's Lou Taylor Pucci. It's, They directed something else, though, I feel like, before Spring. Well, there was one called Resolution. I guess Resolution's the one they
Resolution.
Did. But, yeah, it's been, yeah. Spring, very good. High recommend from me, at least.
Yeah, it's a guy who goes backpacking and he falls in love with this woman, but she's mysterious and odd, and there's a series of murders that seem to be happening around town. But it's kind of like if Linklater did one of his Before Sunrise kind of movies.
Mixed with Lovecraft.
mixed with Lovecraft.
Okay.
It's really good. It's really, really good.
Mm-hmm. And, well, and because, and I'm saying this as someone who didn't love The Endless. I thought The Endless was just fine. So this is, it's a really good movie. But yeah, no, I mean, I'm all into everything you're saying.
Cool.
I think we're all in agreement that there's some interesting ideas here in Wicker Man, but they're not like they're not coming to the surface. They're hidden beneath the bad writing, the occasional bad direction, and then the super high camp of Cage's performance, which I think is really the only reason to ever recommend this movie to people.
Well, like, no, because if you didn't have that performance, there wouldn't really be anything entertaining about this movie.
I will say that I have a friend who hates Nicolas Cage with a passion, but whenever she gets upset, I will send her like gifs and memes from this movie. Nicolas Cage in the bee mat, like in the bee headset, him in the bear costume, like punching one of the girls out, drop kicking Lily Sobieski into a wall. Like, I'll just send them to her and be like, feel better, feel better.
Now, Cap, I believe that you said you had watched The Wicker Tree this week as well, right?
Oh, yes. And I am excited to report on The Wicker Tree, folks.
No, but I'm dying because it's not a straight sequel, right? It's like a companion, but I feel like I read it was bad.
Well, yeah, the star ratings are not particularly good, but The Wicker Tree, which is written and directed by the original Wicker Man director, Robin Hardy, and was in production a long time, was even... It predates this remake in terms of like times it surfaces. It's surfaced throughout like production history. It is. You could look at it and say if you are a fan of the original Wicker Man and you want to see a remake of the Wicker Man that is actually representative of the original film and is also yet still bad and campy, then you want to watch The Wicker Tree.
Oh my god!
Interesting.
It has the same framework of like of essential core plot elements of the original Wicker Man, but a completely different setting and character. Oh, it's so special. Let me describe it to you.
Yeah.
I was watching this film like clapping and laughing the whole time. It's so good. So the main characters are these two country bumpkin Texans, and they are a British author's parody of the American South.
Gosh.
And just like they are cartoons the entire film, and it is ridiculous and glorious. And one of them is basically a reverse Katy Perry. She used to be a hussy songstress, and I love Katy Perry, but she used to be a hussy songstress, and now she's Charlotte Church. So, and she's got a boyfriend, and they're born agains, and they have purity rings.
Yes.
And
yeah,
they go on a mission trip to the pagan land of Scotland to convert the heathens there. And the people in the big cities there, they are not having it. The people of Edinburgh are like, no. And they don't explain it. They just turn them away because there's these creepy cowboys at their door, you know, trying to give them brochures about Jesus. So, but there's a patron who invites them out there because this girl's rather famous, the singer, and everyone seems to like her, even though the stuff she performs is terrible. This movie is not as much of a horror musical, but does in fact have musical segments in it, which is refreshing and cool, except that every time that it's one of her songs,
it's terrible.
Either hussy or Christian is, whoa, crazy bad. So there's this patron and this like this dude and his wife, a lord and a lady, and they are admittedly not the kinds of believers that that they want, but they seem like maybe they'd be easy converts because they like her music. So they invite her out to a small town where the lord of the joint runs a nuclear power plant.
Oh my god.
What?
Which due to an accident has damaged the water table and has made the populace of this small village not able to have children. And he doesn't want anybody to start asking questions. So based on the teachings of his mentor, Lord Summer Isle, played by Christopher Lee in this film in a brief flashback sequence.
What?
Yes. Because originally he was going to be the main actor, but it kept getting delayed so long that he ended up dropping out.
Yeah, he was like super old at this point, because this is a 2012 film.
Because Elizabeth Taylor was supposed to be the female lead, and then they rewrote it for a younger actress when he dropped out.
This sounds like not real. This sounds like a fake thing that you're telling me.
It's fantastical and just left of reality, just like everything to do with proper Wicker Man.
Right.
So the plan is that based on the teaching, this dude is not a believer, but he does believe based on the success of Lord Summer Isle, who's not named, but you know who he's talking about, that he can use the old world practices of this small village to manipulate them so that they are, you know, placated and no one will ask questions about his nuclear power plant. So he arranges for the cowboy and the cowgirl to speak to people about Christianity and sing some hymns, and they think they're doing good work. They're really excited. But of course, the dude gets seduced by a willow-like figure, and unlike the first film, which doesn't have any male nudity, there is at least a butt and behind balls shot.
Oh!
Like silhouette balls, but like, you know, scruffy balls. So I'm all for equal opportunity film nudity, and there was a bit of it.
100%.
I take it.
Ball silhouettes.
But it's, you know, just like the first film, it's not any kind of true representation of pagan culture, but at least it's not awful, except for the part that these people are murderers. But then also, this does take on a certain, there's a certain Burning Man aesthetic that appears eventually in terms of like, you know, fire twirlers and body paint that gives it a certain, all right, this seems dorky now. But it's super fun and weird and well shot. And I really just if I'm going to watch a bad film, I want it to be like The Wicker Tree.
Right.
Well, I mean, I feel like we'd always rather have, if a movie has to turn out bad, at least be interesting. Whereas, you know, what you just described sounds kooky and odd, but like worth a watch. Whereas I can't, in any honesty, ever recommend this movie, this Wicker Man, to people without just being like, well, do you want a batshit Nicolas Cage movie? Because even then, there's better batshit Nicolas Cage movies.
Yeah, but none of them are The Wicker Man.
The bees!
I don't know. I mean, I could easily recommend this movie to someone, but there's a caveat. There's a big but at the end of that.
Go on.
Sorry, I'm just imagining like a close-up shot of like a giant butt ending The Wicker Man now. But...
Oh, my God. If The Wicker Man itself had like a big juicy ass.
Yes.
And like some goats suspended in it.
It's like that Kim Kardashian magazine cover. But it's a Wicker Man. Yes.
If we have any artists among the listeners, please turn Kim Kardashian into a Wicker Man.
Wait, no, and they put him in the butt because it's so big. They don't put him in the chest. He's just in the butt.
And the cheeks close like two doors.
It's like a Trojan horse, only Kim Kardashian butt, and you burn it.
Oh my God.
This is a good idea.
Yeah, I mean, like, but there's gonna be a gay porno about it. I can already envision that.
It's called The Wicker Butt.
Oh, man.
Are you too surprised that there isn't any kind of sexuality in this film?
Yeah, well, no, I mean...
Yeah, there should be.
I am. Well, because especially with the original, like, I mean, when they were showing those people, like, fucking in the field, I was a little surprised.
That just means turned on.
Because it's like, oh, and also, in terms of queer themes in the original Wicker Man, there's not much, except that the innkeeper is clearly a fop. Total fop archetype, and yet labeled as the father of Willow. So I think what they didn't tap into is one of the beautiful things about any kind of like occult societies or pagan societies of any sort, modern or past, is they do integrate queer culture generally.
Yeah,
they're all pretty rooted in the binary, like the god and the goddess, and there's not a lot of in between that happens.
Mm-hmm.
But though that's changing in a lot of modern pagan practices, but. That society on Summer Isle would have no doubt actually had like a lot of pansexuality happening, or just outright queer culture in general. And I think that Willow's dad, who is clearly like portrayed as a fop of some kind, is a part of that and suggests something. If you want to like, you know, write no prize fan fiction stuff into it, like suggest something, some other component of the way Summer Isle operates, which I think is cool.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in this film, all we get is Diane Delano's Sister Beach getting fat shame for not fitting into her bear suit.
Oh, yeah. Like, it feels like the suit shrinks every year.
Though that line is directly, that's the fop innkeeper's line from the original.
Oh, is it?
No, okay. So that's the thing. And I mean, I totally pulled this from Wikipedia, so make of it what you will. But yeah, apparently like as much as 80% of the dialogue is word for word from the original movie.
What?
But with no like heart or character or delivery.
And lacking all context.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, it's the same dialogue in like a completely different context. So it's like, what? I guess this is what happened. Nicolas Cage went to Neil LeBute and was like, hey, I want to make this movie. It's a passion project. And LeBute's like, cool, money. Oh, it's a remake? Oh, let me go watch that. And then he just copied the script and changed a couple things.
So this is this is the Psycho version of Wicker Man with an inferior director.
Yeah.
Do we have other things that we want to talk about?
I know, we're running long. So yeah, anything else y'all want to get out about this movie?
I got some more tangential Wicker Man stuff.
Go.
I got some Wicker Man shout outs. Okay, so are you guys familiar with the web series Yacht Rock?
I'm not.
No.
So this is a web series from like pre-YouTube days that coined the term Yacht Rock. It created the notion of what that genre is. The people who made the series, and it is incredible and holds up really well, and you can watch the whole thing on YouTube. They have a podcast called Beyond Yacht Rock, where they create new arbitrary genres, just as they did with Yacht Rock.
Okay.
And in episode 13, Hollywood Steve Huey created a genre called Easy Wickening. And the idea is that it's music cut from the same cloth as the original Wicker Man. So if you dig the songs from the original Wicker Man, this is a great source for other music like that.
That's kind of fun.
But adjacent to that, that influence did not stop at that time period, because known British actor, comedian, man of many hats, Matt Berry, he's also a musician. Are you guys familiar with Matt Berry?
Name sounds familiar.
He was the boss in most seasons of the IT Crowd.
Yes, I know who that is.
He's the one who talks like this.
Yes.
So he has a recording career, and his albums are amazing, and two records in particular are like directly inspired by the music of the Wicker Man.
Oh man.
Witch Hazel and Kill the Wolf. And they have not left my phone in years. They're so good. He has a great quote about Witch Hazel that reads in my terrible Matt Berry impression.
Witch Hazel is about the terrors of the countryside. I worked out that 1978 was quite an important and formative year for me. I was 4 years old, and in that 1 year, I was exposed to Watership Down and Kate Bush, both of which terrified me. The images were so strong that they left scars that continue to burst and weep.
So I feel that's very telling, and I just want these like have become like two of my all-time favorite records. So I want to share that with anybody who likes the original OG Wicker Man. You got to check this stuff out.
You hear that, listeners? You heard it here first. Well, hopefully first. Maybe someone else has told you that before, but you heard it here.
Okay, well, we're not going to have time for a full game. Originally, I was going to say, like, if you had to redo this movie another time, what would you do? But I feel like we had a really great conversation on that. So your quick and dirty game is, what do you two think was in the bag? Was it a shark or something?
That's what
I
want to know.
What do you think was bleeding in that bag?
Boy, that's a really good question.
So I was gonna say a pig.
Okay. And Cap, what do you think?
I feel like it's gotta be I think it's a male baby or a male child or something.
But my only thing is though, why wouldn't he look in it? If he really thought it was a person.
Because it's a poorly written movie.
But apparently
They don't know, no one knows what's in the bag. No one who wrote this knows what's in the bag.
Apparently what was actually in the bag, like during filming, was a small person.
Oh my god.
It's a terrible job. I hope it paid well.
I want to say that Neil LeBute specifically said it was a little person. I was in the kitchen when I heard that part of the commentary, but I want to say he said it was a little person.
Oh my god. Willow, no.
Oh, fun fact, I have a podcast called State of the Empire, but sometimes it's also called Willow Watch, where we are the only podcast dedicated to Willow.
Aww. I love Willow.
Well, that's actually a perfect segue. Cap, please tell us, what would you like to plug and tell people where they can find you on the social media?
Of course. Well, you can find me at Cap Blackard, BLACKARD and CAP, just about anywhere on social networks and so on. You can find, the Consequence Podcast Network is at Consequence of Sound, and there's a lot of lovely shows there, including Halloweenies, which this season is a Freddy Krueger podcast, mm-hmm. which you find folks guested on for Freddy's Revenge. But most of all, I love the audio dramas that I produce. That's where my heart and soul is at, and I would just love it if you checked out the Call of Cthulhu Mystery Program. You can find it on all your preferred podcast players or at CthulhuMystery.com. We also publish what I should say about this up front is that it is a hybrid audio drama that uses tabletop role playing as the basis for it.
Oh, interesting.
So there's a lot of actual play podcasts, and generally those are just, you just listen to people play a tabletop game. Yeah. But in our case, a subgenre that I've pioneered over the years, that you could say, is an RPG audio drama. So we do the actual tabletop role playing. Everyone's very much in character, and we go in and we then cut it up and add original score, cinematic sound design, and also script scenes to, like, say, flesh out character development or make it so we have a nice, solid, like, impactful episode break or something like that. And it feels like a radio serial, a conventional modern audio drama. But the difference here is that, one, it's a black comedy. So we, like, the comedy comes from people interacting with each other in a very realistic way. And also that in this horror show, the characters never know what's going to happen to them. There's always a degree of, like, real fear and anxiety and a struggle to survive, because the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game has a notoriously high mortality rate.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah, I'm, like, super into that. I don't have a lot of tabletop experience, but I find it all very fascinating.
Our goal is for you to be able to enjoy this show regardless of the experience. You simply have to know that, like, there is a real chance that things could go horribly wrong for these people, and that creates an extra sort of, like, suspense. Series 2, The Terrible Secret of Lot X, just wrapped recently. It's the first one we did as a one-off back in 2015, and it was so popular we've picked it up, and now we're making it a regular event series. So if you want to hear what we do now, I mean, I love the first series, but I highly recommend the second series, and that is where my queer Lovecraftian ethos kind of comes in. There's four queer characters, at least, that are known, and I'm very excited about what it represents in the modern Lovecraftian space.
Yeah, stick it to Lovecraft.
Always.
Hopefully in all sorts of different ways with all sorts of, like, slimy appendages.
Of course. Well, that's awesome. Well, first of all, of course, before we get into our housekeeping, I do want to thank you for guesting on the podcast, because this has been a real treat.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. This has been a lot of fun, and it's taken me down a lot of really cool rabbit holes.
Okay, cool. Well, so before we announce what we're covering next week, I did want to, Joe doesn't know I'm doing this, but I wanted to give a special shout out to some of the queer horror Facebook groups that let us post new episodes on their pages. And also that I honestly just joined to post our stuff, but then have kind of started interacting and engaging with the people in there too. So if you are a fellow horror queer, you know, check out some groups like the Big Gay Horror Fan Club or the Gay Horror Crew, Gay Horror Movie Buffs, Gay Geeks. There's also a bunch more if you just search for gay horror. Honestly, they're all over the place. Anyway, if you want to reach us on Twitter, you can reach me at Traced Thurman.
And I am at B Stole My Remote. That's the letter B.
And if you're tweeting about the podcast, be sure you use the hashtag horrorqueers in your tweets, or you can email us at horrorqueers@gmail.com. We'd also appreciate it if you leave us a review or just a rating on iTunes. Seriously, ratings take 2 seconds. Just do it. And if you like what you've listened to and want to hear even more content, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/horrorqueers, where you can sign up for exclusive bonus episodes each month. Our latest episode is going to be on The Curse of La Llorona, and this month, because this is May when this is coming out, we will have an episode on The Perfection, as well as a mystery film that our $5 patrons will have voted on. And if you want to know what that film is, you can give us money and find out. Joe, what are we covering next week?
All right, so next week we are going international, and we are going to dip our hat into some queer Asian horror with the film adaptation of Fatal Frame.
Now,
Ooh. Yes,
this is the Fatal Frame, as in the video game franchise, and I had no idea this movie existed, but listeners, it is on YouTube for free. Just search Fatal Frame movie, and it's there for your viewing pleasure.
Should be interesting. I'm excited. I literally have no frame of reference for this, so I'm super glad that you seem to know it, and we've got another special guest who's going to help us through the woods. So
yes. So yeah, on that note, I think that we can once and for all, forever, cross out the Wicker Man.
Yeah, and cross out Horror Queers.
I want to dedicate this episode to Johnny Ramone.
This episode was brought to you by the Bloody Disgusting Podcast Network, delivering your weekly horror podcast fix. To find more episodes of this show and others, please visit bloodydisgusting.com/podcastnetwork.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform, or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.